from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, cannabis industry research firms predict that if legalized, California's marijuana industry will grow to nearly $6.5 billion by the year 2020. In preparation, Silicon Valley money is pouring into marijuana startups, but many existing small pot businesses worry they'll be squeezed out by bigger players. We'll discuss the likely winners and losers in the battle for marijuana revenue, how legalization could change California's economic landscape, and the challenges of taxing and regulating recreational pot. That's all up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Californians will decide on this November ballot with Proposition 64 whether to legalize marijuana sales, production, distribution, and possession for recreational use. As part of our series examining Proposition 64, today we consider the question, if legalized, what are the likely economic and revenue effects on the nation's sixth largest economy and its citizens? And what would the pot economy look like? Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We've assembled a panel here, and these are people who are very involved in this question, to put it mildly. David Downs is here with us. He's a reporter who's been covering marijuana issues, writes for Legalization Nation for the East Bay Express, and he's author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook. And welcome, David Downs.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Bo Kilmer here with us in studio, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome, Bo Kilmer.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And we also want to welcome Emily Poxia, who is co-founder and managing director of the Poseidon Asset Management, a cannabis-dedicated investment fund. Welcome.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
Boy, you've all parroted one another. Thank you for having us, Michael. And then let's have Nate Bradley. Let's hear how he responds to our welcome. He's with us from Sacramento. He's executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. And welcome, Nate Bradley.
Thank you for the invite, Michael.
Okay, there you go.
Change it a bit.
Let's launch right into this. And David Downs, let's just get the figures. You know, when we look at, in fact, I think I mentioned in the billboard earlier, and our listeners heard it, that we were talking about possibly figures to the year 2020 of $6.5 billion. If the marijuana industry suddenly allows recreational drugs to be used. First of all, where do we come up with that figure, and how do you even estimate or kind of glean a figure like that?
That's a great question. You know, so much of marijuana activity is in the black market, and it's hard to pin down. But there's been a number of groups, both inside the cannabis industry and outside, in terms of investment groups like Morgan Stanley, who are starting to take a shot at looking at how much the industry makes. So for a number of years, they've been touting around the number of like $2.3 billion for the medical marijuana industry in California alone. And we're seeing numbers about a national industry, when you look at all the medical and recreational states, of something like $40 billion by 2020. And these are throwing darts at a board and aiming for a bullseye. But, you know, because a lot of the market is in the dark, it's hard to, you know, nail it down for sure.
Well, you mentioned the black market, and that certainly figures in really the profits and the economy of marijuana. There's still a lot of states that will be illegal, even if marijuana is legal here. So that presumably is not going to be affected.
Yeah, we could be seeing another 10, 15 years of federal marijuana prohibition. We have 37 states with medical marijuana laws, and we still don't have any federal solution to that. So it could be quite a long time before we have a national answer to recreational sales of cannabis.
We also have a lot of questions if indeed recreational marijuana is passed, Proposition 64 is passed, and a lot of them have to do with taxation, which we'll get into, but regulation, too. I mean, regulatory controls loom as perhaps one of the paramount questions.
That's right. I mean, with prohibition, it's one of the best small business policies you could have. You don't need an education. You don't need a license. You don't need to pay any taxes. You don't need to follow any regulations. You just literally start baking brownies and go into the park and selling them, which is how some of the biggest players in the industry started right now. With full-on regulation and legalization, you're looking at a number of hurdles to even start your company, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars to start up your business.
It's hard enough with regulation of medical marijuana when we get into recreational marijuana. But also, there's been a lot of talk about this is a business and it could become a bigger and bigger bigger business and overshadow those who are in the small business side of this. In fact, there's even been concern about TV ads. How would that affect the likelihood of, for example, the prohibition that still exists against smoking ads? Dianne Feinstein, Senator of California, has at least addressed this and expressed some concern about it. Presumably, if there's a business, it's going to have ads.
You know, there's a question of where the ads would be. Right now, it's federally illegal to advertise any Schedule I drug like cannabis or, say, heroin on a TV news show or a broadcast or a radio station. And any broadcaster who goes ahead and does that ad faces, you know, repercussions like potentially losing your federal license. So even in recreational and medical states, we don't see broadcast TV ads. We are starting to see other advertising avenues open up, whether it's outdoor billboards or even in San Francisco, you can see ads for the Green Cross dispensary on the sides of buses.
Again, David Downs reports on marijuana issues, writes for Legalization Nation, for the East Bay Express, and is author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook. And Bo Kilmer is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Maybe from your perspective, Bo, people need to know that the figures that we're hearing from David don't agree with your figures?
Well, no, I think David hit on the right point, that there's a fair amount of uncertainty here. So, you know, just even trying to figure out the size of the market is very difficult. So I've done the work for the White House and the European Commission, the state of Washington, and the state of Vermont just to estimate the size of their current marijuana market. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. Then when you go forward and try to project what's going to happen, it depends on so many other factors. And especially here in California, it's going to depend on the number of licenses given out by the state, what happens at the local level. That's one of the interesting things about Proposition 64, is that it allows the local jurisdictions to make decisions about whether or not they want to allow retail establishments or grows. And that's going to depend on what happens to the prices and also the assumptions that these analysts are making about how sensitive people are to the price or even what the shape of the demand curve looks like. Now, just to put this in perspective, when we did this for the White House a couple years ago, our best estimate of the total amount of money spent on marijuana in the United States in 2010 ranged between $30 to $60 billion. There's a fair amount of uncertainty there. So I'd say one of the bottom lines here is whether you're participating in the debate in California or in other places, when people start throwing out these really big numbers, you need to come back and ask, how certain are you of that figure? And realize that if you do have numbers that are coming from industry groups, you might want to ask, do they have incentives to inflate the numbers?
Well, it's one of the biggest markets on the planet, but it's also oversaturated. I mean, you've got a lower you got more weed now than you have demand in California, I think it's safe to say. And that's going to increase with recreational use being legalized.
Yeah. Well, what ends up happening to consumption in California is largely going to depend on what happens to the price and what happens to with advertising.
And also with taxes. And let me go to that because I know you actually had an editorial in the Chronicle on it. And it's a central question, how taxes ought to be levied and to what – I mean, there's been talk about evolution of taxes over time, but no one really knows how to tax medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, do they?
No, you're correct. And but, you know, that's not stopping those who are writing ballot initiatives or legislators that are putting bills together from, you know, assigning different bases and rates. And now within California, you also have a lot of local jurisdictions that are making decisions about whether or not to levy a tax on medical or potentially recreational. And, yeah, no one knows the best way to do this.
What's the tax going to be based on? What's the rate going to be?
Exactly. And so, I mean, there are pros and cons with each of these options. Just to give you a couple of examples, you know, if most places are taxing as a function of price, an ad valorem tax, which, you know, is easy to apply. That's an advantage. But as a disadvantage, realize that tax revenue goes down as the prices go down. And depending on how the law is written, there's sometimes if you bundle, you could get around it. For example, I'll sell you this pipe for $30 and give you the weed for free. So you have to be smart in terms of making sure you can kind of stop that bundling. You could also potentially tax as a function of intoxication. That is, you know, potentially, you know, as they look at the amount of THC. And in fact, that's what we do for alcohol. The federal tax is based on the amount of alcohol that's actually in the product. For those from a public health perspective, that has some advantages, but it's easier to do that with a concentrate. But if somebody comes in with a pound of bud, what do you do? Do you take 20 samples and then use the average or the maximum? And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Well, there are a lot of, as you're suggesting, varieties of ways to purchase. You can get vapor, you can get edible, you can get cigarettes and so forth. But I like your suggestion because I read the Chronicle editorial. I think it was that editorial where you said maybe we need an independent board or commission with no ties to the industry to set and update cannabis taxes. It's not done for alcohol, but it could be done for cannabis.
Yeah, that's one idea. I mean, the bottom line is, to the extent that we don't know how this is going to play out, I think it's important for state and local jurisdictions not to get locked in. You know, as we get more information about what other jurisdictions do, as we learn more about the plant, you know, 5 years from now, we may decide, oh, wait, the way we were taxing is not the right way. And so you want to kind of have flexibility to be able to make those changes. That said, if this is an environment with a for-profit businesses and you've got lobbyists, if it's anything like the alcohol or a lot of other industries, they'll often fight against taxation. So one option may be to try to keep the decisions about the tax base and the tax rate, try to keep it out of the hands or away from the influence of private industry.
Bo Kilmer, again, is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Emily Poxia is also with us in studio this morning. She's co-founder and managing director of the Poseidon Asset Management Group, a cannabis-dedicated investment fund. This is what you got, 25 companies in your portfolio?
Yes, that's correct.
This is a big portfolio. And how many here in Northern California?
There are at least 10 in Northern California.
So who are the investors? I mean, you're reading about Silicon Valley people investing, particularly if Prop 64 goes through, but a lot of financial people, a lot of speculators. You read about Pineapple Express. I mean, pretty broad range, huh?
Yeah, we have quite an array of investors in the fund, and we come across a lot of interesting people with interesting backgrounds. But one core through line, I would say, are a lot of lawyers like to invest because they actually understand the legal implications of the industry as opposed to some of the misperceptions around it. And then a lot of entrepreneurs, because I think they understand what it means to be there to break ground first and participate in something from the ground up.
Let's talk about price because legalization certainly has an effect on price, won't it?
Absolutely. We've already seen this happen in Colorado, where the price compression has been drastic, coming down from about $1,800 a pound to, I'm hearing, as low as $800 a pound. And that has major implications on what it means to run your business, watching your margins, and preparing for that type of event to occur.
Well, it raises the cost of production, too, doesn't it?
It can, if you're not savvy.
Or distribution.
Yeah. Yep. You have to watch distribution, but also efficiency, which is better for the environment in the long run as well.
But you need to – this is one of the arguments that the No on 64 people probably will frame. We'll hope hear from them in the course of this hour. This is really looking at the economics and the business more than anything else, because we're going to do a number of shows on this. But maximizing profits, you know, this is business. That's what it's all about. And so you need to create and maintain a number of heavy users, and you need to fight against regulation and taxes, I presume.
Well, there's that way to look at it, but then there's also the way to look at it where there are many ways that this plant can have a participation in our lives, and it doesn't always mean about that race to the bottom in terms of the highest amount of THC. There's all of the elements around CBD and terpenes. So there are many ways this plant can have a part of our lives, and engaging research and understanding doctors' perceptions around this and studying it will help us to know that from a medical standpoint. And then from a well-being standpoint is almost like a health and wellness aspect of the industry. I think there's a lot of ways we can go with that. And again, it will mean a very nuanced approach to having a relationship to the plant.
Well, Bo mentioned the need for state licenses in terms of the effect of that or the impact of that. We've got nearly 90,000 active alcohol licenses. You're going to have a pretty strong regulatory structure with cannabis legal.
Yes, absolutely. I would anticipate it's going to have a heavy-handed approach, at least in the beginning. In Colorado, they've been really good at being responsive to certain things happening around labeling of packages to make sure consumer safety is at the forefront. And I think we'll have kind of an adjustment period in California as well while we watch that.
Well, let's bring Nate Bradley into this. He's in Sacramento. He's executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association, described in a number of ways as sort of the Chamber of Commerce of marijuana or the pot industry, that sort of thing. A man who covers a pretty broad swath of the industry, also an ex-cop, and Really, marijuana's chief lobbyist at this point. Nate Bradley, I got to confess to you, I was fascinated by your background, conservative Christian, Pentecostal, all that sort of thing. I imagine
it enables... Homeschooled, pastor's kid.
Yeah, it enables you to cross over certain borders here that others can't. I mean, in terms of what you got a rep for, which is bringing people who are polarized to some extent together. But let's talk about right now what's going to happen to the small businesses if this passes.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of small folks out there. I mean, there are people who look at our organization and think it's the big corporate folks. And the reality is you know, our average member employs between nine and 11 folks, and so that is a massive concern of ours. We want to make sure that you know that people do have an actual shot. They're not all mowed out, and mowed down within the first year, and we have three corporations that sort of run everything. So what we've done actually with Prop 64 is Prop 64, they have put protections in there for the industry that is operating now. They create priority licensing. What they've also done is create something called a micro business license. And what this license does is, if you're operating in under 10 in a facility that's under 10,000 square feet, you can actually do all functions of the industry under one license. So you can dispense, cultivate, manufactured, as long as you have local approval to do all those things. And what that will do, I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So that'll allow a lot of these small mom and pops to a chance to sort of get a leg up as well, as a lot of people are going to be rushing in, reducing the amount of licenses they're going to have to get and to be in compliance with will be key.
You got about 10,000 pot farmers presently in California. I mean, in the state, Northern California.
The reality is it's going to be tough. I mean, one of my founding board members is a longtime rice farmer, and he's taken me out to his land where he farms about 400 acres of land and has about 1 acre of land set to the side. And he took me out there one day and said, you know, Nate, I've been filling out these food and ag forms since I was 15 years old, and here I am in my mid-50s. I know what I'm doing. These small farmers, they're going to need a lot of help. And that's what we're trying to do right now, is work with a lot of the small farms to make sure they are prepared, because they're going to be going into a brand new world, a world where it's completely gray market, kind of like David was talking about, where you can kind of just grab a house, throw some plants in the backyard, and move that product to the store afterwards, to where you're going to have to follow rules. There's going to be testing. There's going to be local approval. And so we need to make sure that a lot of these businesses are ready to go.
Well, my hat goes off to you if you're bringing through your advocacy some accord between growers and law enforcement and finding common ground. I did need to ask you, though, because you talked about local control and all of that. The 2013 Cole memo means essentially non-government interference. As long as there's strong and effective regulation and enforcement, that's the proviso. And that's something that presumably you can bring into fruition here, so you don't have to worry about the feds breathing down.
That was actually key last year when we were negotiating the medical marijuana regulation and safety act, the bill package, which created the entire state medical licensing system last year, making sure we were in compliance. And so, for that to happen, you need to have strict state regulation and enforcement across the entire state. And so we believe that we've actually done that through the MMRSA, and we will continue to do that with the passage of Prop 64.
Safe to say, though, isn't it, David Downs, that there are a lot of people who don't want pot growers next to them, and they're going to have more pot growers with the passage of Prop 64?
It's tough to say. There's plenty of people who – one of the biggest issues is nuisance reports about odor among neighbors, and there's been a lot of unzoned agriculture going on with cannabis. But the way local control works is that if you don't want to have it in your town, to a certain degree, you don't have to have it in your town, aside unless you're a medical marijuana patient. You can't deny them access to growing maybe a little bit in their house. So with regulation and legalization, we're going to see agricultural zones to hopefully deconflict this issue between neighbors.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Emily Poxia. Industrial hemp could play a role in all this, too. I mean, with new guidelines, it could change the whole industry.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, because industrial hemp is a huge opportunity for the farming society in California. It's a plant that is pretty drought friendly, and it also is a good rotation crop. So it's something that we're seeing in other states that's taking off, like Kentucky. And then globally, Europe is definitely leading the charge on this. Canada and China are also cultivating massive amounts of industrial hemp, and there are endless uses for it. There's somewhere around 25,000 end uses for the plant, all the way from its fibers through to the seeds. So,
and Bo Kilmer, if I go back to you, I don't know if it was maybe been David Downs or you. I've been reading your stuff and his and so forth. But somebody talked about the grapes of wrathization already taking place in cannabis.
I think that was David.
That was David. Yeah. Well, how do you respond to that kind of moniker?
What was the argument then?
It's so the observation that, you know, the bifurcation of our economy between the workers and the owners promises to continue under legalization to the point where you're going to see people who are paid very little to work
the
field.
You're going to see exploitation of labor,
versus the landowners who make the amount of money.
Again, it's big business. We were talking about small businesses and being reassured about that. But, you know, growers are going to expand and the market's going to expand and you're going to have cheap labor. Trump may build the wall, but you're still going to have cheap labor.
Yeah. And I think especially if Prop 64 passes, what it does for the first 5 years, it limits production at about a half acre for indoors and an acre for outdoors. But after, if it passes after 5 years, then you can apply to get a license for much bigger grows. And that's when I think you'd see some really potentially some big companies getting involved.
Big companies, yeah, speak about that, David Downs. I mean, they're going to get involved.
Well, I mean, a big fear of Prop 64, and this is why I've been calling it a Rorschach ink blot test for the public, is people sort of put whatever they want onto it. So a big fear is that multinational corporations like a Monsanto or big tobacco companies would come in and take over the market and exert regulatory control to block new entrants.
But or whiskey companies, alcohol companies.
Yeah, but the reality is it's federally illegal. Anybody who does business at the, you know, mercy of the feds is going to stay away from it, and it's going to stay that way for 15, 20 years perhaps, depending on how long it takes. So there's a strong both incentive on bipartisan incentive actually to keep this small business and not big business, which makes for some interesting bedfellows right now.
Well, yes, indeed. And speaking about bedfellows, I want to invite our listeners to join. in fact, let me do that now. You can weigh in here. We're talking about California businesses seeing green in legal marijuana and Prop 64. By seeing green, I mean not necessarily ecology, but more greenbacks and money. And what is it going to mean in terms of business? And what's it going to mean for the small pot grower? We're raising those questions, but also raising the big questions around economics and legalization. David Downs with us in studio, Bo Kilmer, Emily Poxia, and Nate Bradley with us by phone. And you can join us by phone as well. We invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program with any questions or comments. Again, we'd like to hear from you. The number to call, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways, of course, of joining this program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or any questions or comments you might have can be posted onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Particularly invite some of you who are working in medical marijuana or participating in that world, or some of you who are users of marijuana, cannabis, doobies, whatever you want to call it. Feel free to join the program. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking about what Proposition 64, should it pass, the legalization of marijuana in California, the sixth biggest economy on the planet, what it will mean and what kind of expectations we might have economically and in terms of, frankly, dollars and cents, but also taxes, regulation and so forth, really trying to cover a whole range of issues related to California businesses seeing the legalization of marijuana through Prop 64 as being certainly much more remunerative. And also I want to hear from somebody from the anti-64 side. I just want to remind you that cannabis industry research firms have predicted that if legalized, and we heard this before, to some extent quantified, California's marijuana industry will grow to nearly $6.5 billion. That's by the year 2020. And Silicon Valley is pouring money into marijuana startups. Many existing small pot businesses worried they're going to be squeezed out by bigger players. We're talking about likely winners and losers in the battle for marijuana revenue and how legalization could change California's entire economic landscape and the challenges of such things as taxing and regulating recreational pot. We've got a whole panel with us here in studio. David Downs, a reporter who covers California marijuana issues, and Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, Emily Poxia, who is co-founder and managing director of Poseidon Asset Management, and Nate Bradley with us by phone, executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. I want to go to Grass Valley. Okay. Do they ever call marijuana grass anymore? You still hear that?
Nah, sure. Yeah. Sure.
Do you? Okay. You don't hear it called dope much anymore, though, do you?
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. All right. It's old timers, really, with that kind of lexicon. Don Bessie is executive director of SAM, the Smart Approaches to Marijuana, which opposes Prop 64. And Don Bessie, welcome to the forum program. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot of your opposition presently is tied to what you see as the failure in Colorado?
Well, a failure in multiple levels in Colorado. The industry projections for revenue were wildly optimistic and have been reset multiple times. In addition, the actual hard numbers, we see that marijuana revenue for the state was 0.7%. And that's the top-line figure that does not address all of the societal costs that have come with the legalization of recreational in Colorado. For example, the prosecutors in Aurora, Colorado, just came out talking about all their homicides increases were street marijuana dealers fighting for turf, because one of the unintended consequences was that the high-tax recreational made the street price go up and then more competition for people wanting those districts to sell.
Well, there's more territorial fighting, you mean, and more turf fighting. And we're going to get into debates about Prop 64 later on when we move away from just the economics of it. But I'm interested, do we know, for example, that I'm actually looking at an email from a listener named Chris who says, in the third year of its great experiment, all is going much better than anyone expected in pioneering Colorado. So there's completely argument against what you've just put on board for us here. But do we know that there's more use, for example, among young people, or more people driving under the influence in ways that are affecting peace and harmony, shall we say, in Colorado?
Absolutely. In fact, the quality of life crimes around Denver through the roof. Denver has the highest use rate in the country. And we have to remember that 78% of Colorado does not participate in recreational. So to really feel the numbers, you have to focus in on the places like Denver and Aurora that are full-blown commercial. In addition, we know that they had a huge influx of homeless people wanting to get into the industry and then finding out because they had criminal records or one thing and another, they're not eligible. And so those are further societal burden.
All right, Don Bessie, I thank you for joining us. Wanted to get you on record here. Don Bessie is executive director of SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, which is in opposition to Prop 64. And as I said, we're going to be doing a number of programs which will get into the debate, pro and con. Good question, Nate Bradley, if I go to you. Nate Bradley, again, is with the California Cannabis Industry Association. He's executive director. And William wants to know, how would legalized marijuana change agribusiness in California? What happens when almond and lettuce fields are replaced with marijuana?
Well, it's not going to be a flood all at once. One of the things which I forgot to bring up earlier, I'm glad that I think Bo brought it up later, is there's going to be a cap of 1 acre per license for the first 5 years. So you're not going to see an immediate flood. Another thing which is going to slow down sort of a huge an ag world takeover is the fact that you have to have local approval to operate as well. So you're not just going to be able to get a license from the state and then open up shop. Local governments are going to actually have to get involved in well. And if we look at certain areas, if you an example, you know, 1 acre is going to be the max you're going to be able to get for a long time. A lot of these local counties are taking a much more conservative approach. And so the fear that somehow there's going to be a huge takeover and all the small farmers are going to be out of business is just not true. We have created an on-ramping time for them so they will have a shot to sort of make their mark.
All right. I want to go to our callers, and let's begin. Christopher, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Thanks for having me. A question to throw out there. Everybody's talking about all this big money that California's, you know, going to generate. But the fact is, I've been doing this 20 years. I'm in my garden right now working. I became a felon about 15 years ago over this. Where is that going to put me when I go to get a license? I feel like we're just being shoved out because everybody sees the dollar sign. Well, this has been my livelihood. And if I go to try to get a job at a tech place, they're going to look at my background. I'm labeled as a criminal for the rest of my life because I can't get that felon off of me. So where does that put all of us small growers?
Oh, it's an important question, and David Downs wants to respond.
I think that's a very salient issue, the issue of who can participate in the legal cannabis economy. We've seen it come up in Colorado and Washington. Prop 64 contains provisions that don't automatically disqualify felons from getting a license, depending on what their sort of past felony was about. So if you're a fraudster who committed a bunch of big frauds, you're probably not going to get a license. If you're a low-grade pot dealer or maybe a farmer, you know, you're going to have the opportunity to try to get that license and potentially appeal to the regulatory bodies. Secondly, yes on legalization in California would further the expungement movement in America. We're seeing a number of states go back after legalization, including Oregon and Washington, and conduct expungement clinics that will wipe the records clean of people with past convictions. And I do believe that Prop 64 opens up the possibility to run a similar type of expungement program in California. So people with a pot ticket from 20 years ago who can't be a daycare operator today can get that off their record.
Is that reassuring to you, Christopher?
It really isn't, because at whose cost? I mean, it costs tons of money to go find a lawyer to be able to do that for you. And then court fees, it's just outrageous amount of money. And we're being squeezed out over the billions of dollars everybody's going to be making. Well, I've been living off this for 20 years, and it's given me a decent living for my family. And I realistically, I don't want it to be legal. I have to just put my say-so out there about that.
I'm glad you were able to air your own concerns here, and I thank you for the call. Let me get to another caller, and let's go next to San Jose and welcome Bill. Bill, you're on.
Yes, it kind of coattails off the caller before me. There's still going to be a major black market of dope, and how do you control that? It's really easy to put a seed in the ground and get a plant.
Let me go to Bo Kilmer.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and that's especially important when you're thinking about California, especially up around the Emerald Triangle. There's a lot of production there, and it doesn't all stay in California. So one of the big questions is, what's going to happen to all the black market farmers who are exporting right now after legalization? Will we kind of continue to turn a blind eye and just let them do that, or will we step up enforcement? Realize if this really is going to be regulated, you can imagine that some of the people with the licenses might not like the fact that people down the street without a license are producing are able to get away for producing without all the, without dealing with all the regulations. So one of the big questions about how this is all going to play out, especially in terms of its implications for the rest of the country, is what's going to happen to a lot of those people who are growing illegally and exporting.
You're still going to have the same problems with the black market. In fact, one could argue they may even be exacerbated because
We would expect – I mean, you're not going to shut down the black market overnight. We would expect that over time, though, especially as the bigger grows come in and they push those production and distribution costs down, that over time that's going to squeeze out the black market. But in the transition period, yeah, I mean, now that we're going to have this whole – you know, if Prop 64 passes, there's going to be a separate bureau of of regulation that's going to have to make decisions about whether, you know, what they're going to do with respect to those who are legally growing.
Another concern here, and I want to get to this forthwith, Emily Poxamira, comes in an email from a listener who says, I support the legalization, but if big business gets a hold of it, I'm afraid super additive strains will be developed. It must be kept away from the GMO processes of the tobacco industry. And then this is maybe kind of a footnote. Also, marijuana seems like a natural fit to augment seniors' limited income sources. Maybe that's why he or she's in favor of legalization. But what about super additive strains and all that?
The potential is there that those companies will want to modify things the way they have with other areas of agriculture. But the reality is that the plant itself has so many variations and different aspects to it that we're such a far way to even understand all of those elements of the plant that it will likely take some time. And there's just the plant works so beautifully already that there's no real need to really be going that route right away.
David Downs.
Yeah. I would just add that if you're worried about what you're putting in your body today, California cannabis consumers are inhaling tons and tons of unregulated illegal pesticides. And there's no effort to clear up that aspect of the trade right now. And it could be decades away before we'd see the first genetically modified cannabis plant.
At least the government's not spraying with toxic material anymore.
Right?
Yeah.
And here's a tweet from Dominic. And let me go to you this, Nate Bradley. He says, the recent Ninth Circuit cannabis court case, that's the one that banned Justice Department from prosecuting medical marijuana cases that comply with state law, is, Dominic says, the current solution. That is businesses and consumers being protected under state law. And you say what, Nate Bradley?
I didn't catch the first part. What was his?
He says the recent cannabis court case, that's the solution, that businesses and consumers are protected under state law.
That isn't what that does is, that's not the final answer. You still need the state rules there in place. And that's what we're trying to do right now. Mm-hmm. That court case only helps, is only a Band-Aid. They were also very clear in that when they brought it up and when one of the justices wrote the first time that this is only a temporary fix, that this isn't supposed to be. He actually put it in their opinion that this isn't a permanent fix, this is a temporary fix, and that we need to see action in Congress for a permanent fix. But regardless of that, the state still should push forward to create rules and regulations for the industry that's in this state right now.
And again, Nate Bradley is with us from the state capitol, and he's executive director of the California Cannabis Industry Association. And Michael's our next caller. Michael, you're on. Welcome.
Yes, hello. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I love the program. So my question is about the financial aspect of the banking industry and the federal regulation. My understanding is it prohibits the depositing of the cash from proceeds from marijuana sales into banking. And so there's this problem in terms of payroll, paying taxes, all sorts of problems that are created by that. I have heard from prior programs that there is some way that they can pay their taxes in cash, but is there anything that the panelists or that California can do to address this issue? I would fear that having a lot of cash on hand can lead to criminal activity, and just in general, in terms of making payroll and doing and conducting business, it's problematic to deal solely in cash. I'll take any response off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. You're going to have to hire Brinks people or something. Emily Poxia, what about it?
Yeah, and thank you for raising that, because it is one of the largest pain points for people running businesses in the industry, because it's not safe, frankly, to have a lot of cash and cash transactions occurring. On the positive side, we're seeing some technology platforms that are being created to address the payroll issue and to really work with the business operators in this cash-only environment that then can transition. But we are hearing, just last week, I heard three more businesses lost their banking relationships here in Northern California. It seems to come in waves. And it's definitely something that we're hoping we get some real clarity on from the government about how this can run. And I have heard rumors that the state of California is working on creating a community banking program just for California for that exact reason of being safe. And I think David Downs wants to add to that.
David?
Sure. We're currently under collecting our medical marijuana taxes to the tune of around $50 to $100 million a year. And so Board of Equalization member Fiona Ma has been working on setting up like a first cannabis bank or credit union that the state would run for them to be able to take deposits. Because currently right now, dispensaries are coming in with duffel bags full of really smelly dollar bills. And the Board of Equalization, the tax collectors in the state, have to hire more staff and check every $20 bill is not counterfeit and hire extra security to come take tax revenue here in the state. And it's pretty absurd. I know Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom.
The old nose plugs we used to wear when we went swimming. You
exactly.
Know, smelly currency.
Lieutenant Governor's been saying, look, if we pass this on November 9th, we have Washington, Oregon, and California and all of its representatives in D.C. clamoring for banking reform. And they speak with a much louder voice than if this fails on November 8th.
Mm-hmm. You remember, I'm sure, David, when they were talking about raising revenue with recreational use of marijuana in Oakland and wanting to go that route and so forth. I mean, a number of cities have talked along those lines and so forth. This would allow Prop 64 would allow much more of that to take place?
I think we're in the middle of a taxapalooza in California. Every city council has gotten wind of the fact that this might become legal on November 8th, and they have already been passing local taxes to mirror state taxes.
Yeah. Taxapalooza. A word to reckon with. Actually, I'm looking at a comment here from a listener who says, if we didn't like the tobacco wars, why are we heading toward the marijuana wars to come? And another listener named Bill says the panelists seem to be working on the assumption that Prop 64 will pass. Is there a backup plan if it doesn't?
Well, we have the medical initiative that's going to be going into effect in 2018. So that's progress there in terms of regulation and providing more clarity and transparency around the types of products you're consuming, the testing around it, taxation of it, regulation of it. So that would be – it would be disappointing for us personally if Prop 64 didn't pass. But there are things in place and in the works to improve the whole regulation.
And there are quite a number of callers in place here. Let's go to as many of you as we can. I'm sorry, David, do you want to say something?
I just also wanted to add that Lieutenant Governor, you know, mentioned again that this is – legalization is happening in California. It's happening on a continuum right now, and it's a question of whether or not it happens faster or slower. With medical regulation last year, you know, that gives you a license to put on your wall saying you're a legal medical marijuana grower in this state. That's catalyzed a huge boom in investment because it's 100% legitimate from a medical point of view. These sort of regulatory steps around medical precede regulating recreational. And so we're moving down this path. It's just a question of how fast.
And as you intimated, Lieutenant Governor Newsom is a major advocate, of course, mm-hmm. for this. And let me get some more of our callers on. Let me go to Bob next. Bob, you're on.
Hi. Let's get back to planet Earth. This is about a lot of money. That's why there are venture capital. That's why there are, you know, that's why there are investment banks involved in this. And then what happens in these situations is eventually regulators revolve the door out into lobbyists. Things will change. We will have advertising. We will have people pushing this. And that's the reality. Whether you want it or not, that's a different question. But that's the reality of what will happen economically because of this law.
All right. I'll let that statement stand unless anybody wants to challenge or respond.
I would
respond.
Just weigh in that, like, cannabis can't be a regulation. There can't be a referendum on regulatory capture and late capitalism. We have major problems with late capitalism in America, including regulatory capture. Cannabis legalization has turned into this Christmas tree that everyone wants to hang their personal, like, progressive ornament on. And it's in danger of failing, and we're going to continue to arrest, you know, tens of thousands of blacks and Latinos every year for this pretty much legal activity.
Well, he said come down to earth. I don't know if this is coming down to earth or not, but we haven't talked about it yet. We'd be interested in what some of you have to say about the idea, because it's been bandied about, of a marijuana tourism industry like the wine industry with appellations like wine, high quality, organic, unique to the region. Is this likely to happen, Emily? Yeah.
I definitely see that as something that's going to happen. People love to nerd out around this plant just like they do with wine or even beer. Beer is something that we're seeing incredible tourism around. So I see a lot of parallels around that for sure.
And didn't you talk about Miller High Life kind of quality maybe associated with the marijuana industry or something along those lines?
The other thing about Prop 64 is that it allows local jurisdictions to potentially open up or license marijuana lounges or marijuana bars, which would make it a lot easier for tourists that are coming in, because that's one of the issues in Colorado. You have these tourists coming in and you know, they can't consume outside. And so you've got then the hotels that will fine you $500 or whatever if you smoke in the room, and some people think it's worth it. So some of the hotels are making money off of this, and so one of the things that would be different
Could maybe have weddings on pot farms like they do in wineries.
Oh, yeah, that's happening. That's happening.
Yeah, it's already happening.
That would be my only comment was we had 30,000 people up in Santa Rosa in December, which is a really bad time of year for wine country. And they were there to celebrate the Emerald Cup, which is the world's largest outdoor organic medical cannabis competition. We had 25,000 people out in the high desert, 90 miles east of L.A., just in July in like 98-degree heat for a hash competition. So intrastate cannabis tourism and out-of-state cannabis tourism is already occurring, but it stands to increase.
Well, a lot will then depend on what happens in other states. So if you're an early mover like Colorado and if California passes, you have a lot of tourists coming in for this. But as legalization spreads, you may not necessarily have as much. But that said, wine is produced all over the place, but people still like to come to Napa and Sonoma.
Well, you mentioned Colorado. This gets us right back to the tax question, Bowen. I know this has been of concern to you. I know in Colorado and Washington it's a function of value, but Alaska, which is soon going to have legalization, and Oregon, it's a function of weight.
Yeah, well, actually, Oregon just switched over to where it's ad valorem. But yeah, it's interesting. In Alaska, they are going to be taxing it at $50 an ounce. And once again, like pros and cons with all of these options. The advantage there is, once again, that's very easy to collect. You just measure it and then you do that right at wholesale level. But one of the potential drawbacks to a weight-based tax is that it gives the producers more incentive to produce really potent marijuana. And a lot of public health folks are worried about some of the more potent marijuana. I mean, most of the research that's been done about the health consequences associated with marijuana was based on kind of lower grade, kind of lower potency marijuana that was smoked. But now we're in a world where it's higher potency and not everyone's necessarily smoking. So there's a lot more research that's going to need to be done.
Well, there is going to be more research because there's been a green light now on research that never existed before.
Well, no, it was there before, but it's going to be easier because – previously, if you wanted to do research with marijuana in the United States, you could only get that marijuana from a farm at the University of Mississippi.
Right.
And what was discussed a couple weeks ago is that's now going to be relaxed. So we could expect more places to be able to produce it, maybe producing different types of products, just to make it easier to get access to do that research.
And let me please remind listeners, because I know there are many of you who have concerns about the effect of marijuana and youth and so forth on drivers. We're going to get this is just focusing on how legal marijuana could affect California's economy. It's just one in a series of shows on Prop 64 that we intend to do. We're going to examine health effects, positive or negative, of marijuana use in another show. Here's William, who asks, if legalized, what would be the tax revenues to the state from production and product sales? What are the formulas for paying taxes by growers, by revenue, by quantity? What? Has an economic analysis been done indicating revenue to the state from growers?
The Legislative Analyst Office did a report, I think it was late December, early January, and their best estimate is that state and local governments could eventually collect tax revenues in the high hundreds of millions, potentially over a billion. But a couple things to keep in mind there. First of all, there's uncertainty about that. A lot of people in California are talking about $1 billion right away. That's not going to happen. It's going to take some time. But as I said, when you're doing those projections, so much is going to depend on the decisions that the local governments make and then also what the federal government does. Because realize that a colleague of mine did some calculations and estimated that if you looked at all of the THC, so the cannabinoid that's most responsible for intoxication in the cannabis plant, if you looked at all of the THC that's consumed in the United States, you could probably produce that on 20 farms in Iowa. There's money to be made on this, but once you have federal legalization and you have and you're in a situation where it's legal to export it across state lines, that's dramatically going to produce those production distribution costs, which is going to push the prices down, which is going to affect the tax revenues that come in.
Well, there's also talk about tax revenue being tied to levels of THC.
And that's something that I'm really interested in, and I wish it received more attention in these debates. As I said, most of the discussion focused on ad valorem. You did have Oregon initially did a weight-based tax, but I'm hoping that over time, as we have more serious discussions about this, we move toward at least having a debate about THC taxes.
And again, Bo Kilmer is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center. David Downs is author of Legalization Nation for the East Bay Express and author of Medical Marijuana Guidebook. You want to add something here, David
Sure.
Downs?
Sure. So the tax is 15% at retail sales, and then it's $9.25 an ounce for bud versus $2.75 an ounce for lower quality shake and leaf to start in the law.
Good to know. Let me get another caller on. Jennifer, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I'm a San Francisco real estate agent, and much of my family, I have many family members that live in the Boulder area and little towns around Boulder, and they have said that the real estate prices in the neighborhoods have just skyrocketed because a lot of the pot industry is paying all cash for the homes around there so that they can invest it and actually obviously get money out of it.
Wow. What's happening with techies here in the Bay Area? Is happening with marijuana in Colorado?
I was in
But
Boulder.
It's because they can't use the banks, you're saying, Jennifer, right?
Exactly. They can't put it in the banks so they're investing in property.
Yeah. Well, here again, unintended consequences. Let me thank you for that call. We'll just let it stand and get another caller on here from San Francisco. Ryan, you're on.
Yes. Hi. My question is regarding hemp in California. I know that there's a National Hemp Industry Association, and the U.S. imports millions of dollars in hemp from Canada and Hungary, China, et cetera. Companies like Dr. Bronner's soap company in California have to import hemp. How will 64 affect the hemp industry?
Yeah, Emily Puxia, you touched on this a bit before, but he wants to know overall effect on the hemp industry.
Well, I think it's great that we could open this up in California and the Central Valley and cultivate hemp because it is. It's something that can be used in all of those products that you were mentioning. And right now they are seeing positive results in Kentucky with cultivating hemp, and they're also seeing it in Canada, which similar climate. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity here, and it can really help things. I know a company like Dr. Bronner's would love to say USA-made hemp, and the National Hemp Association is a great resource for understanding the policy around that.
We have one quick question from you, Will in Geyserville. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. This is,
quick. We got a bad connection there. He just wants to know about certification for small farmers. I couldn't hear his voice. Anybody know about certification for small farmers in terms of 64?
Just Prop 64 is really strong. It's pro-small farmer sort of components, and you'll be able to trademark your local appellation.
Well, the debates will continue. We certainly managed to flesh out a lot about economics and business in terms of this hour, taxes, regulation. My thanks to David Downs, to Bo Kilmer, to Emily Poxia, and to Nate Bradley, who all joined us on the panel for the hour. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Jeremy Siegel, and Susan Britton. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Sheffer-Wolf. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for listening. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.